Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into the weeds with some crucial source material. We're looking at two very specific, but I think interconnected challenges facing international law and, well, the whole global system right now.
That's right. On the one hand, we've got a highly technical legal debate. It's about a major weapons treaty, but it has profound humanitarian implications.
And on the other,
a much broader strategic view. It's based on a recent analysis looking at the shifting global power balance and, frankly, the struggles of the UN in this new era.
So our mission for you today is pretty clear. We want you to grasp the nuts and bolts of the legal arguments nations are using, especially in conflict zones.
And then connect that to the bigger picture, how values, interests, and raw power are reshaping the world order, or maybe the disorder.
Okay, let's dive right in with the legal challenge first. It concerns the 1997 Mine Ban Treaty, the MBT.
Mm-hmm. This treaty is, or at least was, seen as a cornerstone of humanitarian disarmament. Its whole purpose is saving lives, prohibiting anti-personnel mines, requiring clearance, helping victims, you know, the works.
But you said was. It sounds like it's under serious pressure.
Existential pressure, you could say.
Yeah.
And the main driver, unsurprisingly, is the war in Ukraine. Russia, which isn't even a party to the treaty, has been documented using at least 13 different types of these mines since early 2022.
And the human cost?
Staggering. Hundreds of civilian casualties. The sources cite 580 in 2023 alone, just from landmines.
580? That really grounds this. It's not just abstract law.
Absolutely not. And it's not just Russia under the spotlight. Ukraine, which is a state party, is investigating reports that its own forces might have used certain rocket-delivered anti-personnel mines near Izium back in 2022. Those are the PFM or butterfly mines.
Right. Those are particularly insidious. And this pressure extends beyond Ukraine itself.
It does. We saw five other states' parties actually withdraw from the treaty altogether in 2025. That's the Baltic states, Finland, and Poland.
Why did they withdraw?
They cited the changed security environment because of the war next door. Now, the withdrawal is obviously a blow to the treaty, but the analysts we're looking at make a distinction.
Because they aren't currently in an armed conflict themselves.
Exactly. That differentiates their situation, legally speaking, from what Ukraine is now attempting, which is not withdrawal, but suspension.
Okay, let's focus on that suspension. What exactly did Ukraine do?
On July 21st, 2025, they formally notified the UN Secretary General that they were suspending their obligations under the Mine Ban Treaty, effective retroactively from July 17.
And their justification. What legal leg are they trying to stand on?
They're citing the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, the VCLT, specifically Article 62.
Article 62. Refresh my memory.
That's the one that deals with a fundamental change of circumstances. The idea is, if something completely unforeseen happens that totally changes the basis upon which a state agreed to a treaty, they might be able to suspend or terminate it.
And how are they applying that here? Their draft national law apparently says the suspension is temporary just until the war ends.
Right. Their argument hinges on the 1994 Budapest Memorandum. They claim they relied on those security assurances, you know, from Russia, the UK, and the US, given when Ukraine gave up nuclear weapons as the essential basis for their consent to join the Mine Ban Treaty.
So the argument is, Russia gave us security guarantees, we joined the treaty based on that stability, Russia invaded, destroying that stability, therefore the fundamental circumstances have changed.
That's the core of their claim. The invasion fundamentally altered the essential basis of their consent, is how they frame it.
Okay. On the surface, facing an invasion, that sounds understandable, maybe. But the legal analysis in our sources says this argument is deeply flawed. Why? What's flaw number one?
Flaw one goes right back to the Mine Ban Treaty's own text. It prohibits landmine use under any circumstances. That phrase, under any circumstances, is pretty well established in international law, like in the Chemical Weapons Convention, too. Meaning, it's designed to apply especially during armed conflict, not just in peacetime. The preamble itself is rooted in international humanitarian law principles, which state that methods of warfare are not unlimited. So, the treaty is built for crisis, not meant to be set aside during one.
So the very situation they're in is exactly what the treaty was intended to cover. Okay, what's the second flaw? This one involves the VCLT itself, doesn't it?
Yes, and this is quite specific. Ukraine leans on VCLT Article 62 for the fundamental change argument. But Article 73 of the same Vienna Convention explicitly states that the VCLT provisions, including Article 62, generally don't apply to situations arising from the outbreak of hostilities between states.
Wait, so the VCLT itself says its rule about fundamental change usually doesn't kick in just because a war starts?
Pretty much. It creates an exception specifically for armed conflict situations impacting treaty relations. So you can't really use one part of the VCLT to justify suspension due to war while ignoring another part that says war itself isn't typically grounds for invoking that rule.
That seems like a significant legal hurdle. What's the third point the analysts raise?
Foreseeability. The sources argue that when Ukraine joined the MBT, it consented to be bound by its rules, regardless of the type of armed conflict it might face later. War wasn't an unforeseeable event when signing up to a humanitarian disarmament treaty.
So engaging in hostilities was precisely the kind of circumstance the treaty was meant to regulate, not an excuse to abandon it.
Exactly. It wasn't an unforeseen change in that sense.
I get the legal points. They seem strong. But stepping back, isn't there a basic tension here? Expecting a country fighting for its very survival to strictly adhere to a treaty that might limit its defensive options.
That's undeniably the harsh reality and the core tension. But the analysts are really hammering the dangers of accepting this suspension. First, the immediate humanitarian risk.
Giving Ukraine a perceived green light to use mines again.
Yes, potentially creating vast, dangerous minefields that will inevitably harm their own civilians for decades to come. It's a terrible legacy to leave.
And the second danger?
The legal precedent. If the international community tolerates this, it drastically weakens the norm against anti-personnel mines. It could open the door for any state in any conflict to say, well, circumstances have changed, we're suspending our obligations under crucial humanitarian treaties, think chemical weapons, cluster munitions.
It undermines the whole framework.
Precisely. It goes against the very spirit cited by the ICRC president that international humanitarian law is built for the darkest times, not just for easy peacetime conditions.
So given these flaws and risks, what are the immediate recommendations from the analysis?
Three main things. First, strongly urge Ukraine to retract the suspension immediately. Second, for other states parties to the treaty, they need to submit formal legal objections to the UN Secretary General. There's a deadline under the VCLT Article 65, Paragraph 2, which falls on October 17, 2025.
So lodge formal complaints, basically.
Yes. Make it legally clear they don't accept the validity of the suspension. And third, at the upcoming meeting of states' parties in December 2025, they should adopt a formal clarification, making it absolutely explicit that suspension is not a permissible option under the MBT.
Lock down the interpretation before this becomes a real precedent.
Exactly. Shut the door on this argument legally and politically.
Okay, so that's the micro-level crisis, a specific treaty under threat. But you mentioned earlier this connects to a larger systemic issue. Let's zoom out now.
Right. Let's shift to that second set of sources, which analyzes global governance through a speech by a leader from, interestingly, a relatively small country, Finland.
And they offered a framework for thinking about foreign policy.
Yeah, a really useful one. They broke it down into three core pillars: values, interests, and power. The argument is that smaller countries, lacking overwhelming hard power, have to rely more strategically on promoting values and pursuing interests through cooperation. Smart diplomacy, they called it.
And the backdrop for this analysis is the current global situation.
Very much so. The speaker was blunt. The post-Cold War order is gone, finished. We're in a messy, dangerous transition period, maybe 5 to 10 years, before a new order settles.
A key point being that every state, big or small, has a role in shaping whatever comes next.
Absolutely. Agency matters. And the analysis identified three major global developments driving this transition. First, this tension between multilateralism on one side and multipolarity or transactionalism on the other.
Okay, break that down. Multilateralism is...
That's the ideal, right?
Yeah.
Based on rules, laws, international cooperation through institutions like the UN.
Versus multipolarity or transactionalism.
Which is more the current reality. States are diversifying their relationships, not strictly aligning with old blocs. They're driven more by immediate national interests and a cold calculation of power dynamics. Deals are more transactional.
Makes sense, but is there a warning attached?
A crucial one. The speaker warned that while transactional politics might seem pragmatic, it must still be grounded in fundamental values. If interests and power completely override values, well, history suggests that path eventually leads to conflict. War.
Okay, that's development one. What's the second?
A clear power shift. The global balance is undeniably moving south and east towards Africa, Asia, Latin America.
Driven by?
Economics, mostly. Expanding economies, but also just demographics, population growth. This shift gives these regions more hard power, yes, but also soft power, cultural and political influence. and they will use it to push for their interests.
Even with this shift, are there core values the speaker insisted must unite everyone?
Yes, the bedrock principles of the UN Charter. Sovereignty, territorial integrity, banning the use of force, and respecting human rights. These have to be the baseline for all 193 UN members.
And they apply these values to current events.
Directly. Condemning Russia's aggression in Ukraine, obviously. But also citing Israel's actions violating international law in Palestine and calling out states using places like Sudan or the DRC for proxy wars. Applying the standard universally.
Which leads logically to the third development identified.
The state of the UN itself. The speaker argued the UN is fundamentally failing in its core mission of ensuring peace and stability. And a key reason is that its structures, particularly the Security Council, don't reflect the current global power balance. They still reflect 1945.
And this failure of the UN actually fuels the move towards that transactional, power-based world order.
Exactly. If the collective system doesn't work, states feel they have no choice but to rely on themselves or specific allies, accelerating that multipolar transactional trend.
So the speech didn't just diagnose problems, it also called for action, especially regarding ongoing conflict.
Definitely. It highlighted the horrifying fact that there are more wars raging now than at any point since World War II. The core message: aggression must not pay off, thinking specifically of Ukraine. Accountability is vital.
What about the Middle East?
The humanitarian situation in Gaza was described as unbearable. The calls were for an immediate ceasefire, full humanitarian access, and the release of all hostages. Standard calls, but urgent.
And longer term for Israel-Palestine.
Strong support for the two-state solution, acknowledging recent efforts by France and Saudi Arabia, but emphasizing it has to genuinely address the security needs of both Israelis and Palestinians. That means ending the 1967 occupation and building a Palestinian authority capable of governing.
There was also a specific call regarding recognition.
Yes, a point often missed. Countries that haven't yet recognized Israel were urged to do so as part of a comprehensive move towards peace.
The analysis also stressed not forgetting other crises.
Critically important. Violence is spiking in Sudan, the DRC, Haiti, Myanmar, Mali. The list goes on. The point was that all these conflicts need equal determination. Peace processes can't just be transactional deals based on power. They have to be guided by international law.
To make any of this possible, though, requires fixing the institution, the UN, what reforms were proposed.
Big ones, aimed squarely at the Security Council's outdated structure. First, increase the number of permanent members. The specific suggestion was adding, for instance, 2 permanent seats for Asia and 2 for Africa, reflecting that global power shift we talked about.
That alone would be a major change. But what about the veto?
This was maybe the most radical proposal. The argument was no single state should hold a veto. And furthermore, if a permanent member of the Security Council blatantly violates the UN Charter, like, say, through illegal aggression, their voting rights should be suspended.
Wow. Getting rid of the P5 veto or suspending it, that fundamentally changes the nature of the council, doesn't it?
Completely. The veto is the absolute core of the 1945 power structure embedded in the UN. Removing or limiting it would make the council potentially more democratic, more representative, maybe more effective, but far less predictable for the current major powers. It challenges their entrenched position.
So the overall vision for the UN?
Get back to basics. Focus relentlessly on ending and preventing wars, protecting human rights, pushing sustainable development. And crucially, the UN needs to reclaim its role in peace mediation. Its absence, the speaker argued, is actually helping conflict spiral.
And how did Finland position itself in all this?
They concluded with a pledge. If elected to the Security Council for the 2029-2030 term, they're promised to be principled, sticking to the law and the charter, but also pragmatic, looking for achievable, incremental progress. It reinforces that idea. Even smaller states need to navigate this tension between values, interests, and power to help shape what comes next.
Okay, we've really covered a lot there, from the nitty-gritty of treaty law concerning landmines,
all the way up to restructuring the UN Security Council and redefining the global order.
But there's a clear thread connecting them, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's all about compliance at the end of the day. Will nations actually live up to the obligations they signed on to? Especially when it gets tough during war, during periods of intense geopolitical competition.
The Mineban Treaty example shows us, in sharp relief, what happens when a state feels its immediate security interests clash with its treaty commitments and tries to find a legal loophole.
A loophole, the analysis argues, just isn't there, legally. And the consequences, both human and systemic, are huge.
While the analysis of the UN and the shifting world order shows the broader canvas, what happens when the institutions designed for cooperation based on shared values struggle to keep pace with raw shifts in power?
It fuels that dangerous drift towards transactionalism, where might starts to make right and collective security erodes.
So that tension we talked about between national interests driven by sovereignty and power and those supposedly universal humanitarian values and legal commitments, it feels incredibly acute right now.
It really does.
And maybe the final thought for you, the listener, is this. What is the real world cost when a global system designed for cooperation fails to adapt, and when individual nations decide their commitments are optional? We see part of that cost measured in landmine victims in Ukraine, and part of it in the prolonged, seemingly intractable conflicts where international law and mediation struggle to gain traction. Something to think about.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the source material.